We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 5022, and we'll begin with Senator Cox.
I'm going to defer to, I
yes,
think.
Yes, of course. Senator Bryant and Representative Snow and Representative Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Neil Bryant, Senator from District 27, and to my right is, of course, a representative from that same neck of the woods, and we're going to take just a couple of minutes. I'm happy to say we thought we might have to take longer, but we worked out some misinformation over the evening and this morning, so it'll only take a couple of minutes. A few weeks ago, we made a presentation to the committee dealing with Central Oregon Community College Higher Education, a group called CORAB, which is an advisory group that has been put together by the Chancellor's Office. It includes a lot of business representatives and community people from Central Oregon. And by the way, Central Oregon Community College is involved in about six different counties, and including the Warm Springs Indian Reservation. So it's a huge geographic area that is affected here. And the idea was to continue and improve the University Center, which has been very successful in Central Oregon. It allows people in Central Oregon, in this area is about 150,000, to get a four-year education without having to go 120, 130 miles to a four-year campus. The college and the taxpayers of Central Oregon have paid for a new library that accommodates 70,000 square feet with 20,000 available for the expansion. The e-board supported an expansion, and there are currently 600 students in Central Oregon enrolled in this new type of university. All it will be 700, and the prediction is by the year 2003, there will be 1,200. And they can get their education a little less expensive tuition-wise because their first 2 years are at a community college rate, and then the last 2 years are at the standard college rate. Usually they'll at a rate closer to Eastern or what Southern stand rather than Oregon or Oregon State. So it's a wonderful opportunity, and it's a good buy. Today, Chancellor Cox confirmed that in his budget, the proposal that's before you, there is $500,000 included for the continuation of the new programs that will be brought to the Central Oregon campus to continue this. And there are five or six program areas that CORAB, the advisory group, has selected, including computer science, business, humanities, and education. So it's an exciting time for us, and you basically do this without physically creating a new campus. A lot of it can be done electronically. Currently, there's 9.5 staff that are involved in this and paid for through the current university system. The other element of this is there will be one class room building built. It'll be 41,000 square feet. Central Oregon Community College will donate the land, the infrastructure. They will sell certificates of participation to do the construction costs and be responsible for it. It's $5.8 million. The Higher Education Board has agreed to sign a lease to help fund the cost and making the bond payments. It's going to be a long-term lease, probably 20 years, and it's anticipated in a very short time they will completely fill that classroom building with the programs for higher education there. And I'm convinced that once the building is up, that 1,200 goal will be quickly exceeded. It's the idea of you will build it and they will come. This CORAD group, when they studied this during the interim, found that they had a minimum of 1,000 individuals in Central Oregon that had this unmet need for higher education and they couldn't afford to go to the Valley Fork. So it will also then allow you to get a degree in a shorter period of time. Right now, if you stay in Central Oregon and go through the current university process, it takes 7 or 8 years just because of when the courses are offered. So it's exciting. We had a heartburn yesterday and the day before because we weren't sure that the money was included in the higher ed budget, but now we learned it is there. And so we're very supportive of this budget going out. And I'll turn to my colleague to see if they have any additional comments.
Tim Canope, State Representative from District 54. Obviously, COCC is and the university system is in the district, and we just want to let you know that locally there's a large commitment from our community. Neil's mentioned the donation of land, the fact that the taxpayers have bitten the bullet and built the library and some of the infrastructure that's needed. What we're just asking is just a small piece from the university system budget, which is currently there, and to get that going along with the long-term lease to the building. And it'll move us a long way toward the educational, satisfying the educational needs that are there for citizens and for business in Central Oregon, in Bend.
Representative Ben Westland, District 55, Central Oregon. Again, just to augment some of the comments that have already been made, obviously goes without saying that I am very much in favor of this allocation and your kind consideration of our budget request. But just to flesh out a little bit of Neil's numbers, the market study was conducted not only with the help of local community members, but our august committee staff, Steve Bender, helped over the interim in establishing the total market share of how many kids were not going on to college that would go on to college if they had a four-year degree granting opportunity close at hand. One of the very salient points here, one of the things that continues to get lost in the discussion, and that is that the Bend area is the largest city in the continental United States without a four-year degree-granting institution within 100 miles. And all of our other community colleges, I'm not saying anything negative against them. They all do excellent work. They all have community colleges to help augment their four-year degree-granting capabilities in the university centers. Central Oregon Community College does not. Largest city in the continental United States without a degree-granting, four-year degree-granting institution within 100 miles. That's a pretty significant statement. Anyway, with that, we'll avail ourselves of questions, and we appreciate your time and consideration. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Representative Brock?
I want to just hear again the numbers on the handout demand.
Yes.
Students who were not going to school.
The information that there was a group of 100 in the community that took a look at this, facilitated by the Chandler Center, and they came back and they pulled business leaders, they pulled students, went into the community and did a survey, and it was about 1,000 students. These were not being met in the district of the community college, and. Currently, and we expanded it, as I said, last year, and they have 600 enrolled in the program now. They'll go to 700 next fall, and with this allocation, that'll continue to ramp up, and by 2003, they think they'll easily have 1,200 involved in the program, which is about the size of Eastern, and we've been able to accomplish that with no new campus.
Mm-hmm. And so the net from the higher ed budget is $500,000.
For the additional programs that I outlined, there already is in the budget for the existing programs $400,000.
Okay.
So for the next 2 years, there'd be an additional $500,000.
Okay. Okay. And these students who are availing themselves of this opportunity, what tuition do they pay?
They pay a tuition rate that's close to what Eastern and Southern Oregon University charge once they get into the third and fourth year.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the classes are offered by Eastern, University of Oregon, Portland State, Southern Oregon. OIT wants to bring an engineering program there. So that's the other unusual feature of this. We'll have all of our universities and colleges involved. In addition, Linfield and Merrillhurst offer classes for two, and of course their tuition rates are higher depending on what they need to make it financially feasible.
So let me understand: are they paying the rate or the tuition from the parent institution that's running the program, or would they be paying your rate there?
For the first 2 years, it's the community college.
Right. Uh-huh.
For the next 3 years, I believe the rate that's been charged in the past has been the lower Eastern type rate.
Okay.
It depends upon the institution. For example, some of the programs are more expensive. They would pay the OIT tuition, the OSU tuition, the Southern tuition. But the average, as Senator Bryan says, the average is probably in the range of Eastern, Southern, and Western tuition.
And so just one sort of follow-up. So the result of this would be that students in your area could get a four-year degree without ending up with this tremendous debt burden that so many of our students have, who have to relocate and who have to get student loans and just to subsist if they can take it there. Then we're getting a set of students out without that big debt burden at the end, or with a lower debt burden.
Right, because they either live at home or they're already married and have a home and they take these courses in the evenings, weekends, whatever, and so they don't have that additional cost. So it is less expensive in that regard, too, because, frankly, many of them couldn't financially afford to take time off work or move to Eugene, Corvallis, wherever to get the education.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
President Brass? Or, I'm sorry, President Edwards.
We look alike.
We do.
Thank you.
You both have glasses.
I'm not wearing my necklace. I guess, Neil, you raised the question of growing enrollment. How are you going to meet that capacity? And I think when you testified before, you talked about a facility. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a 41,000 square foot building that Central Oregon Community College will donate the land, the infrastructure. They'll go out on a certificate of participation, probably 20 years. To help pay for that, Higher Education is going to sign a lease to use the building. And if they don't use all the space, COCC will rent back the remainder of it because they need the space too. The planning is already going on. The engineers, the architects have been hired. Higher Ed and the community college have basically designed what they need in the building. So it's the hope is that it will be constructed and open in the fall of 2001.
And this is a question for staff. The payments that will be made, the lease payments, will that come out of Higher Ed's operating budget or out of their capital
budget? Operating budget.
Which one?
Operating.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, Senator.
Do you folks see this as a kind of permanent long-standing solution, or will there be need sometime for a state institution?
It's an evolving process. I think that this will work for the next 5 or 6 years, and then depending if we continue to grow the way we are in Central Oregon, if the demand and the need is still there, we'll either have to build another building, do something to try to accommodate that and bring more classes here. Right now, the tone of the advisory committee and Chancellor Cox can address this better than I, because he attended the 8-hour meeting, is that this is the best of all worlds as far as working with all the universities and colleges and having them respond to what the needs of the community are with a variety of courses. And they like to have that flexibility rather than being tied to one particular institution. But 5-10 years from now, this will be an evolving process, and I think the discussion will need to go on. But I think this will be good for the next 5 years.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Ross.
Would you just reiterate the process about COPs and how that works?
The Community College Board will authorize the sale of a COP for $5.8 million, which will be the construction, the engineering, the architectural cost. We'll put up the building. The interest rate they anticipate is somewhere between 5.25 and 5.5. They'll amortize it over 20 years. And that will be paid for to a large extent by a lease that a Higher Ed signs. I think ultimately they'll take the whole building. But the space they don't take, COCC will lease back then from Higher Ed, and that will make the payments on the bond.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
We promised you this morning a 30-minute crisp presentation. Now, I haven't gotten your attention. No, I'm just kidding. I'm Joe Cox, Chancellor of the University System. We know how pressed you are for time for work, and we'll do 30 minutes, but we would like to have you
here about teacher education. We've talked with you about high technology. We've talked with you about natural resources. We are equally concerned about events going on in teacher education, particularly with the retirement of large numbers of our teachers, just as our faculty are retiring en masse in the universities, having come here in the 60s, so are our teachers. And there are some serious shortages. We've asked Dave Mighton from TSDC to tell you briefly what those shortage and high demand areas are. And then I would like to have you hear for a few minutes from Shirley Clark and President Betty Youngblood from Western. We've asked Western to do this, speaking for all the teacher ed programs, because while Western is much more than teacher ed, certainly today, its long history of service and outstanding contributions in teacher ed make it certainly a preeminent program. So Betty will be here to talk with you about teacher ed in general across the system, but using Western as the example. And we promise you 30 minutes, and appreciate your time.
Betty, I guess you might all three come up at once.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Shirley Clark, and I just want to make a very brief introduction this morning. Oregonians want an educated and productive citizenry, a safe and caring society, and a sound economy. I think that given the events of yesterday in Littleton, Colorado, which are very much on our minds, we also want safe and caring schools. We want high-quality schools as well. They are essential to Oregon's vision. And high-quality schools require well-prepared educators from pre-kindergarten through graduate school. A strong partner with our schools and colleges of education is Oregon's Agency for Licensing Teachers and Administrators. This is the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and as you know, Dr. David Mighton is the director of the commission. We thought it would be helpful for us all to hear briefly about the shortage areas that have been the subject of intense study, and to reflect on some of the ways that the Oregon University system is working with the Commission on teacher preparation and workforce issues. So David will be first this morning.
Thank you. I'm Chair and members of the committee. Early this session, we spent a couple of mornings with you talking about the redesign of licensure and the alternative licensure for charter schools and other topics of interest. And so my appearance this morning is essentially to answer questions that you may have that hark back to those earlier comments, and to comment very briefly on the teacher supply and demand. During 1998, TSPC had a special committee that composed of commissioners and external parties, including representatives of the state system of higher ed, to look at this issue of teacher supply and demand. You undoubtedly have read in the news that 2 million teachers will be needed over the next 5 years to replace retiring teachers and accommodate to the increased number of students. That report is pretty shocking at the outset, but when you read the fine print in the articles below, they reflect what we found in our study of supply and demand here in Oregon, that the supply of teachers is adequate for the upcoming shortages or the upcoming changes in education if we're able to continue the production of teachers at the level we now have and retain more of the beginning teachers. Education Week recently has had a series of articles on the teacher shortage, and one of the things that they talked about was the benefits of an induction system, a mentor system, if you would, that would help to adapt to the changing needs of schools and the influx of a lot of new teachers. Oregon produces about 1,100 teachers a year, and we import approximately the same number from other states. those who are in the 1100 from Oregon are new teachers, but they may not be the typical 22-year-olds. Many of them are adults who have made decisions to make career changes in midlife. In addition to the 2,200 that are produced, the number of people coming back into teaching who previously held licenses is estimated in most states to be as many as 35% to 40% of the new hires are really not new to the system. So it is a complex task to try to estimate what the actual supply of teachers would be if we faced a real shortage. What we do know, however, is that there are certain fields in which we are preparing teachers that we do not have an adequate supply. Oregon University System produces about 600 teachers a year, and the first slide that you're seeing shows you the variety of fields, some 30 fields in which these teachers are prepared. In our study of the supply and demand this past year, we identified 11 fields which are areas of high demand. I'd like to comment just briefly on each of these because the reasons for high demand vary. On the English as a second language bilingual, the changing demographics of our state contribute to this need for teachers to teach English as a second language. With regard to mathematics teachers, the competitive field and the career opportunities that exist for people in mathematics and physical sciences are competing directly with schools for the talents of these individuals. And you see that physical science and chemistry, or physics and chemistry, are listed here, the physical sciences. Those are the shortage areas. We do not anticipate a shortage in life science or integrated science, earth science. But as you've heard earlier in these presentations from the university system, the high-tech areas are ones that are drawing people who have the ability to work in those fields. We talk here next about teachers who can work effectively in technology. We're speaking primarily of electronic communications here, and computers and internet and that sort of thing, and distinguish that from one that's farther down the list that deals with professional technical. I'll speak of that in a moment. Middle school teachers who are strong in math and science are recognized as a need, and this is driven in part by the school reform legislation that increases the expectations for middle schools, and particularly the expectations in math and science. Professional technical is the term we use for what at one time were called vocational areas, and these are areas like manufacturing, construction, graphics, communications, the professional areas where the teachers will likely be working toward the CAM programs. Foreign languages are a shortage because we have not given much attention to foreign language in schools until recently. After a big surge in foreign language instruction during the late 70s and early 80s, we had a fairly significant decline in emphasis, and the new standards for schooling will require an increased attention, particularly in Spanish, which seems to be the language of preference at the moment. Special ed teachers are a shortage all across the country, and one of the reasons that they are a shortage is because of the demanding paper workload that's involved with meeting federal requirements for special education. Those are very difficult tasks as well, working with students with a variety of disabilities, some of whom require full-time aid just to provide for the physical needs of these students. Counselors and are in need at the moment because of the changes in the 21st Century School Act that requires more emphasis on career guidance. Speech pathologists are a field that also competes with the medical profession. Many speech pathologists work in
recovery of stroke and accident victims, and it creates an artificial market for speech pathologists. And finally, school administrators, particularly high school principals, are in great demand as a result of a high number of retirements in recent years. It's more apparent in the administrative ranks even than in the teaching ranks. We've worked closely with the university system and the analysis of data that's available either from our files or the Department of Education, and believe that the requests that they're making of you are accurately stated.
One quick question here. David, what is the failure rate on the test? People graduate, take the test. What is the failure rate on that initially?
Representative Minnis, I would need to know which tests you're referring to. We have tests for basic skills, for subject matter, and for professional knowledge.
Okay. It's probably basic skills with the new graduates coming out of the
We don't test for basic skills at the level of graduation. That's an admission requirement for teacher education. So for those who complete the teacher education programs, 100% of them have completed the basic skills test. If they didn't pass the basic skills test, then they were blocked from going on in the teacher education program. But if you ask me, of all the people who set for the test, and we don't know who these are, these could be graduates, they could be freshmen in programs, just overall, 78% of the people who take the California Basic Education Skills Test and have the scores reported to Oregon pass on the first attempt. If you take those who are tested on the second attempt, then it gets up to approximately 90%. What happens to some of them who take it once and never come back, we're really not sure. I guess many of them decide this is an indication that teaching is not a career for them. I mentioned the CBEST test, the California Basic Educational Skills Test, because that is a test that is produced by National Evaluation Systems, which also produced that Massachusetts test, which caught so much attention last fall.
Okay. I had an administrator I don't know if this was this particular test, but indicate to me that the tests that people coming out of the institutions are taking are so difficult. It's a very difficult task. Have you heard that complaint?
Representative Minnis, Oregon has high scores on its test. Our scores are either first, second, or third in the nation on most all the tests. We share that space with California usually as either first or second in the list. On the test of professional knowledge, which all teachers take, of the 170,000 teachers who were in the norm group for the last report we got from Educational Testing Service, our passing score of 661 is at the median on those 170,000 people who took that test nationally, which means half of them would not have met Oregon standards.
Thank you. Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your testimony again about this issue, which I think you're highlighting a critical problem for us as a state, not only today, but long term. I guess the question that as policymakers, I'd like to see if you could give us some thought on how do we address this? You're highlighting specific areas that obviously as we go down the path of education reform, those are going to be in higher demand, demographics are going to change, hence ESL needs are growing. What is it? I mean, and I'm going to ask Dr. Youngblood to comment on who's getting into these programs. After your presentation, but what type of student is going into teaching, period? Because I see this as a really big problem for us, whether we're going to succeed at higher ed or K-12, this is a big problem.
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, the reason I went through the list and commented about the different reasons for the shortages was to in a sense say there's not one size that fits all in terms of the fix for these. Some of the districts are now offering signing bonuses for teachers in special education. That's an incentive that we're seeing across the country, and even if California offers signing bonuses and special ed, it affects Oregon's supply of special ed teachers. You have a national market rather than just a statewide supply and demand issue. But in some areas, I think recognition of the additional work that's required in special ed would certainly go a long way to helping to ameliorate the problem, because we have an oversupply, really, of elementary teachers who could, in a few months, be trained additionally for special education. And if there were some incentives there, I believe that it would show benefit. With regard to some of the issues of demographics or underrepresented groups, one of our big problems is insufficient numbers of minority persons in education. We have upwards of 16 to 17% minority students, and fewer than 3% of the teaching staff are minorities. That's a major problem that we've been working with all of the institutions on trying to address that. And in order to address that quickly, we need to be able to recruit teachers from other states as well. And we have been making efforts. Tomorrow, for example, I'm going to a teacher fair in Tacoma in an effort to make Oregon's needs more visible to teachers in other states. So there are a variety of solutions, and each of these would need an analysis and a solution to fit it, I think.
Well, maybe my own commentary would be that I think it begs the question of, you know, the value of what we're saying, who are important in our society. And, you know, clearly, we have a debate in this building about how much we should be funding for schools, and we tend to talk about the teachers and how much they're getting paid or not getting paid. It isn't money, but quite frankly, in my opinion, that makes a lot of people go into this business. But if you look at those degrees, there's this marketplace that you're describing, both within the system as well as outside. Technology, higher ed, seeing the same thing, where Intel and Microsoft is picking off either in the colleges or looking for people who can they can groom, takes away from mathematics, and as you described. So it's a very complex issue, and, you know, for me, I guess that's, again, an argument to why we need to continue to look at what we're doing and the values and the messages we're sending to the teachers who ultimately are going to provide the service. Because this shortage is going to grow if we keep, in my opinion, underfunding our schools. I mean, that's where I'll come out on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what Randall was saying, because that's a good point. And I think we need to get at quality, make sure that we have quality people coming through this process, and that we retain quality for teachers. And I just wondered what your thoughts are about how good a job we're doing at first attracting really quality people into teaching, and then retaining them once they get started in the profession.
And Chair Senator Crow, the Oregon programs in the last decade have substantially upped the entrance requirements for teacher preparation, mm-hmm. and have imposed standards comparable to admission to graduate schools as a requirement for admission to an initial teacher education program in terms of grade point average, test scores, academic preparation. So I think we've really made significant strides, and in the redesign of teacher licensure, we have also created the alternative entry into teaching that I've spoken with you about before, the transitional license that will make it easier for people from business and industry at mid-career to come into teaching. And those are very positive things. The studies on what happens to people once they get into teaching are not very encouraging, however. At least a third of the people are gone after the first year of teaching, and after 3 years of teaching, most studies show half of the beginning teachers are no longer there. One of the things that we believe is important is a good induction system, and one of the reasons that we've spoken with you before about the merits of mentors.
How do you assess working conditions and compensation and sort of lifelong satisfactions that come from the teaching profession. A lot of us have donated our lives to that and found it in the past to be a very rewarding kind of lifestyle, but is that the perception of the future?
Madam Chair, Senator Joe, I don't really have the information to answer that question. It would be personal opinion only.
Senator Gordon?
Thank you. Good morning. You said that many of the teachers leave after a year and others leave after 3 years. Are there follow-up studies that tell us why we lose the teachers after that period of time?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, one of the interesting things I've read recently is that Education Week article that talks about the stress that teachers feel during that first year and how having assistance from the district and from their colleagues in terms of making the adjustment is a very important element. We have not done any studies in Oregon, however, to assess why leavers are doing so. There was a national study done by the National Education Association called Leavers, Payers, and something, I've forgotten exactly the title. But there is some national information that I would be glad to get make available to you if you would like.
Thank you. Senator Hartung.
David, as you know, you and I and Betty have talked a lot about teacher education, and the Senate Education Committee is committed to finding a way to enhance the professionalism of teaching. And just to add what Senator Trill said, we know that one of the things we must do if we're going to get our best and brightest high school students to follow the profession of teaching is to get the beginning compensation up. A person with a fifth-year master's goes into teaching, probably can expect to start about $28,000. The same person with a master's degree can go to high-tech for $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. So we view that as our primary responsibility in drawing in. But my question is, at this moment, Head Start teachers are not required to be licensed at all, but the movement across the country is moving towards licensure. And what sort of a task would it be for you and your commission to develop a license for Head Start teachers? And the reason I say this, I'm working with Senators Wyden and Smith's office right now to see if we can get Head Start schools started as public charter schools. And so we need to address the licensure. What kind of question are these?
I'm sure Senator Hartung, licensure applies for age 3 through 21. Those are the grades or the ages covered by public schools. And so our early childhood education endorsement is required of districts to have programs down to 3 years of age. And we don't have very many, as you know. Below age 3, we have what we call the early intervention, early childhood endorsement. It's essentially intended to identify children with special needs early and try to address those needs before they reach kindergarten age. So we do have licensure structures, I think, that would address the Head Start level if school districts were offering that program. With regard to the early childhood early intervention, that's really under the Department of Education, however, and they have a process for identifying the competencies that they require to operate those programs, which are funded directly through the Department of Education.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Some more questions on that. Representative Leonard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up on the question that Senator Gordley asked, and he said that Oregon had not done any studies, but do you have any kind of feel for whether the trend line changed 10 years ago, 5 years ago, that can give us some kind of indication of when we started losing one-third and one-half?
I'm Chair Representative Winters. I believe that the high attrition in teaching has been a long-standing problem. What has created some of our shortage, however, is that the state system of higher ed is producing 900 to 1,000 teachers a year in the early 1990s. Then under the strictures of ballot measure 5 and directions from the legislature, they've reduced that production by at least a third. And the areas in which they're preparing teachers are in those high shortage areas. As a result, it has exacerbated the issues of shortages.
Thank you. Representative Beckley?
Thank you, Chair. My comments kind of reference Senator Gordley's, and we're basically on the subject of maybe why so many teachers are not retained in the first 3 years. Having experienced education for a long, long time and talking with a lot of people, I remember the first year I taught, I think it was about 2 hours a day of preparation time. And that went on quite a bit for the first 3 years. And so I think probably combined with family life and other things, that might be a factor. I think some other reasons, the paperwork is pretty horrendous, as you've indicated, David. Lesson plans have to be written. You have to consider within a class of whatever number it is that there are a large variety of students, some on IEP, some are regular type students, some are tag students. If you have maybe two or three different types of classes to teach, maybe a U.S. history class, maybe an American government class, for example, you have to prepare in each of those. It's quite time consuming. You have to correct tests, particularly if you're giving essay tests. It takes a lot of time. There's a lot of challenge in that regard. I think a lot of teachers today perceive that they're not getting as much support from administrators and or parents as they deal with kids, disciplinary problems and other situations. Real or imagined, it doesn't make any difference. That is the perception, I think. Large classes certainly add to stress and to the difficulty of teaching. And I guess it's like anything, that's no one thing. It's kind of like, I've often said to kids, if I put my hand out and you put a single piece of paper on that hand, that wouldn't be very heavy. But if you put 500 papers on my hand, the ream of paper is fairly heavy, and it's kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. So it's very rewarding, very interesting, it's very challenging, but it's also very difficult. And I don't know that pay has any great factor in those early years, really. I don't think most of us went into that for pay. But anyway, there are so many things, very difficult to list them specifically and get a really good idea, a good handle on the problem, I think.
Just a comment, and in short, I would encourage this committee or some committee to take this up as perhaps an interim project, because you just outlined it as multifaceted. It's alarming. If we're investing through higher ed, a number of students and half of them are falling out within the first 3 years, we're disinvesting. And so somehow we should continue, and the shortage isn't going to get any smaller. So, as a body, I think we need to get a better handle on are there things that we can do that might encourage, and even at the higher ed level, to try to brace the new teacher what it is that they're going to be confronted. And maybe that's part of the problem. We just heard from Representative Backlund that they get in there and there's things they didn't anticipate, or there's a lot of stress, paperwork, things they didn't either know or didn't anticipate. So I think it's a worthwhile endeavor somehow, whether it's through this committee or another one, we have some interim group look at that.
Okay. Thank you very much, David. And I'd like to move directly to Dr. Betty Youngblood, who is president of Western Oregon University. We have a very important and very extensive education program at many levels at Western Oregon. And Dr. Youngblood will speak to programs and the system as a whole, but give you a more concrete flavor of what is going on by mentioning what Western specifically is doing.
Thank you, Shirley. Good morning, Representative Nittis and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betty Youngblood, Western Oregon University President. All of the institutions in the Oregon University system, with the exception of the Oregon Institute of Technology, offer programs in teacher education. all of the institutions are very active in working with TSCC and working with the Oregon Department of Education and in working with various school districts on school reform implementation. In other words, to prepare students today to teach tomorrow in the standards-based kind of education that you've been discussing. This is a very different approach from the way teacher education has been handled in the past. Teacher education has changed quite dramatically. It is no longer business as usual, just in terms of some of the approaches that we now use. In your notebook, I'd like to draw your attention to this. It's this document, which, I'm sorry, it's in the very back of your notebook. This was recently prepared in the university system by our Dean's Council on Teacher Education. And it's a document that if you haven't had an opportunity to look at, I would heartily recommend it. It's one of those that is presented in bullets and can be read and the content grasped very, very quickly. A good bit of variety in it. The document has had input from all of the campuses, and so every school or college of education in the Oregon University system has been involved. All of our teacher education programs across the system are highly field-based. They all require close collaboration with school districts, and this is something that applies across the state and involves all of the OUS institutions involved in teacher education. Our programs in the university system are a mix of undergraduate and graduate level, or that is post-baccalaureate, programs for the initial license to teach. Our campuses also play a very important role in providing courses that current teachers need to move from their initial license to their continuing license. And of course, if you look across the state, all of the schools and colleges of education are very much involved in providing professional development kinds of opportunities. Workshops, courses, advanced degrees. There are things going on in every school or college of education on a regular basis, a wide variety of programs. I believe we are going to have a slide that, there it is, that addresses the 600 new educators from OUS institutions that are licensed annually in Oregon. The number of 600 includes 34 teaching specialties, counselors, school psychologists, and administrators. And while I mentioned that all of the schools in the Oregon University system except OIT offer teacher education, no one school offers all of these specialties. And so while you may hear that teacher education is here and it's there, indeed, many times what we're talking about is a totally different program from institution to institution because there are many, many different endorsements and authorizations and the programs available. In addition, as the slide indicates, over 900 graduate degrees are awarded each year in education. So we're very much involved right now in the Oregon University system in preparing teachers for the 21st century standards-based schools. We've been spending a good bit of time learning about and helping our students understand the certificates of initial mastery and the certificates of advanced mastery. I'd like to share with you just a very small number of examples of some of the partnerships, and in this case I'll draw primarily upon Western Oregon University, but some of the partnerships that we have with school districts. And this document, again, prepared by our system deans, is very, very helpful in outlining example after example from various institutions. But to give you a couple of quick examples, Western Oregon University works with several districts in Oregon to improve the capacity of teachers in the areas of technology, bilingual education, math and science, reading, and middle-level teaching. In many instances, teachers are able to earn master's degrees as a result of these programs. They earn master's degrees at the school sites, meaning, in other words, that they do not have to come to Monmouth to study at Western Oregon University, but our faculty go to these school districts. And often, the master's degrees earned are tied to the improvement plans of the school districts in which the teachers are employed.
And this means that given the district, whatever specific district we might be discussing, and whatever the specific circumstances, you may have anywhere from 20 to 30 to 50 to 60 teachers in a given district working in depth on specific parts of improvement plans. And I would suggest to you that when you have that number of teachers developing new approaches to meet the needs that have been identified for a specific district, that you can have rather quick and powerful and often compelling change in that district. The point is, and this would be true of every OUS campus involved in teacher education, we are helping prepare our students to meet the new standards. We are asking the school district, what do you need? We aren't telling them only this is what you need. We're asking them, what do you need in your specific districts? And then in many cases, we are tailoring coursework accordingly. Another example, to look at another institution, would be PSU and the efforts that PSU makes to help address the special needs of urban schools. All of our schools of education are involved in working with school districts, but all are constrained by current budget limitations. This is a point that really I'm reminded of on a regular basis. I'm constantly told by our faculty at WOU, for example, that they've received a call from this district and three calls from that district and four calls from some other district, and they could do X, Y, and Z to help these various districts. And they do lots of specific things, but that in addition, they find that there are so many questions we get and so many requests that we can't respond to simply because of time and because of staffing. So the more we can expand these programs, the more able we will be to be even more effective in working directly with the school districts and responding to very specific requests. Research and unique kinds of expertise exist on all of our OUS campuses, and they're very important to understanding what's happening in teacher education and some of the recent developments. Let me share one example with you again from Western Oregon University. We have a division of teaching research at Western, which operates annually on a budget of approximately $5 million in grant funds. Sometimes that number is a little higher, sometimes it's a little bit lower. Grants primarily from the federal government, but other grants as well. One of the research projects underway, something that has been underway for quite some time in our teaching research division, is known as the Teaching Effectiveness Study. And this particular study has collected data on about 1,000, a little more than 1,000, of our student teachers at WOU and about 20,000 of their students. And the intent is to help teachers understand what they can do to bring about greater learning gains among their students. Also to predict what kinds of behaviors will not only bring about those greater learning gains, but enable teachers to be as effective and as efficient as possible. In the years ahead, we know that all of our classrooms are going to be culturally more diverse and that teachers are going to have more responsibility for helping students understand what learning style will work best for them. In other words, how these new teachers can meet the requirements and the expectations of standards-based education. Kind of reminded in closing of a document I saw recently from CSQC making the point that world-class schools require a world-class workforce. And ladies and gentlemen, that is what the schools of education, the colleges of education in the Oregon University system are seeking to do, to prepare that world-class workforce which can respond effectively and will respond effectively to standards-based education and meet the challenges and opportunities that you've been discussing. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have a question that might best be answered by someone representing TSU, but I'll try this out anyway. On page 7, in the examples of expertise scholarship, there is a statement that says preparation of teachers and administrators to work in metropolitan schools and with students not currently well served by K through 12 schools. My question is, what are the characteristics of the students who are not well served by K-12 schools in this context? And then what is the special preparation that teachers and administrators are receiving in order to work with this population of students?
Senator Gordley and members of the committee, we are at an advantage this morning in that Dean Philip Edmondson of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State is in the audience, and we'll ask Phyllis if you respond to your question.
Representative Minnis, Senator Gordley, it's a pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Phyllis Edmondson, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University. I think there are a couple of characteristics of children who are not well served, and that those are children who come to school with particular problems and issues that are often the result of disadvantage in terms of economic conditions in their homes and families, in their communities. They may come to school without some of the prior experiences that children whose parents are more able or more knowledgeable about early childhood experiences might bring with them. They may experience great family stressors, and some of this is the result some of this is concentrated in urban areas. Some of it appears in classrooms and schools in rural areas as well. So when we talk about preparing children to work in metropolitan schools, we're not isolating those as being totally different from any other school. But often we see concentrations of problems that children experience in areas where the economic conditions that their families experience are very difficult. If we look at the data on teenagers, for example, and teenage crime, when you begin to look at that very carefully, you begin to see that it's closely tied with economic conditions and economic realities. We know that schools in cities have traditionally done less well by children and young people than schools in more affluent suburban areas across the country. I think Portland is quite fortunate to be much less seriously affected by some of those issues. But we take very seriously at Portland State our responsibility to help teachers understand the realities of urban schools. We place the predominant number of our students in urban schools or in high-poverty schools so that they can learn to teach in those settings with teachers who are doing a masterful job under those conditions. And I hope I got at the question. I'd be glad to answer follow-up.
You did get at the question, Madam Chair. It's somewhat alarming to me to read this particular statement. It acknowledges that we have children who are not well served by K through 12 schools. That's what it says. And I was just trying to understand what is it that we're doing especially to prepare teachers and administrators to deal with that reality, at least the reality as it's been stated.
Representative Minnis, Senator Gordley, I share your concern. I do believe, I think I wrote that statement, at least submitted that, and I do believe that the schools have served many children in this country very, very well. But there are many children that the schools have not served well. And that's a critical piece of the new realities we face in the preparation of teachers, is that it isn't enough to teach the children who are easy to teach. Those we really don't get paid to do. They would probably learn without us. The job of the teacher, and the job that is increasingly difficult, is to teach the children that we haven't done so well by. And as you begin to disaggregate the data, the achievement data, we have many schools in which children are doing, which many children are doing very, very well. And in all schools, some children are doing very well. But we've got to continue to look. And I think that's a key part of the Oregon Reform Agenda and the Reform Agenda nationally, is to say it's not enough to do well by those we've always done well by. But we must do well by all children if we're going to have a society that lives out its promise to children and young people.
I really appreciate your response, and I accept it, and I agree with it. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Well, the only thing I'm concerned about the response, however, is the fact that, to me, the burden's at the school. And a lot of the things you just described are not school-related. So often we tend to put a lot on schools, hence what we just saw yesterday and last night. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the school's fault.
Right. That's right.
Representative Minnis and Representative Edwards, if I might make just a brief response to that, I couldn't agree more. The reality, though, is that the children who present at the schoolhouse door are the children that we must educate. And for a long time, I think some of us in the profession have said, well, you know, the children come with all of these problems, and we've been sympathetic to those, but we've not looked at saying, okay, that's the reality. Now, how do we help them learn? And I think that's a focus that teacher education in Oregon is really taking very seriously right now. So it isn't an either-or, and I'm very sensitive to the issue of what can schools legitimately do with the resources that are allocated for intellectual development.
Just quickly, could you tell us what you think should be done to reduce stress on first-year teachers?
Representative Minnis, Representative Ross. I think we ought to begin the first year for teachers in much the same way we do the first year in any kind of a job, and that is that you start out doing less than you will do at the end of your career. The first day that I was in an elementary classroom as a sixth grade teacher, I was doing exactly the same job that I was doing on the last day that I was in the classroom 7 years later as an elementary teacher. And I had no, and this is a long time ago, but the fact of that is still the same. That is, the first day is the same as the last day. We really need to help people phase in. We need to provide them support. We need mentoring programs. We need an array of those support systems. And in terms of our special ed teachers, we've got to find a way to help them with that paper burden. And that's probably going to mean some additional support staff, just as we've provided additional support staff in almost every other career and occupation in the country as the paperwork demands grow.
Thank you. Thank you. Park, if you wanted to go ahead, we'll go ahead and do a brief presentation. Before we get into
this, Representative Minnis and members of the committee, we are ready to conclude.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Before anybody leaves, I want to remind everybody to show up at 8:30 on the dot tomorrow because we're doing work sessions on the committee. So we'll have a lot of work.
Not doing it today.
Not today. We're not. It's kind of taking it 10 o'clock.
Okay.
Representative Minnis, members of the committee, I should have known when I brought you a topic about which we all care very much that to do it in 30 minutes was not going to be possible. If I may have your indulgence for just 1 minute, my close will begin as Dr. Ashkenazi began, focusing on results. And I think that we ought to be, I feel very good that we're proposing to give you a university system.
I apologize for this. There's one thing I guess I'd like to have you go on the record on, which is another category which hasn't been presented, is the system in producing professors. Could you just comment on how, we just heard about how you're doing for elementary school and the quality there. I'm not questioning that, but how are we doing with graduate students and the mission of the OUS to try to keep that up, because I know that's very going.
Well, it's obviously... Chairman and Representative Edwards, it's obviously a major concern of three of our institutions. Our doctoral granting institutions have the responsibility for that contribution to the professorate, to the profession. U of O, OSU, and TSU, through their doctoral programs, are in fact producing the next generation of faculty. Not for ourselves, because we don't tend to hire our own. In fact, we try not to, because we want to bring a varied professorate to the classroom. I believe that we have not slacked off in that regard. I think we're more focused than we were. Measure 5 put us through some hard decisions about which graduate programs, and I think that all three of our doctoral institutions have put their resources where their strengths are. They couldn't be everything, and some hard choices were made on all three of those campuses. But if we had the time, I would love to have you hear from the three graduate deans. We just simply had to truncate. But we haven't, for those three institutions, our AAU, our land grant, and our urban, that mission is still very much in their thinking.
I
care very much about it.
I apologize for interrupting your close.
No, I appreciate the time for the question. But what I want to have you see in these next two slides is that we are committing to results. I'm not going to run down through these with you. They're in your materials. You can read them. We know that we are going to test ourselves, pressing to increase our retention rates, our graduation rates. We're committing to results where more of our students will enter key fields in teaching, computer science, engineering, etc. We're trying to bring more of our students with 3.75 grade point averages, retain more of those we admit, improve their scores on exit skill exams, because that's the key measurement of the output. We're shifting from input to output. We're going to do that by increasing our internship opportunities so they'll be better prepared for the real world of work that they enter. And we're committed to those partnerships that you've heard so much about, the community colleges and the private sector. Let me just close with this. And this is, I think, what drives me, is the belief that when all is said and done, my colleagues and I, and our legislative colleagues, are not going to be judged by necessarily the amount of dollars we raise for our foundations, although important that is, or our one loss record in athletics, how many buildings we've built, how much of that capital construction we've overseen. I think we're going to be judged by two things, you and I and my colleagues. Quality of the faculty that we bring here, and the way we nurture them in their professional development, and the quality of our graduates, and what they do with their lives. Bottom line. We appreciate your patience and your indulgence, and we look forward to being resources during the work sessions as they unfold. Thank you for your time and patience.
Thank you very much. We're going to have some comments from our local officer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to point out that we've distributed three items to you that should be available today. The first is a copy of the management letter on the way to audit, that's to say the Secretary of State audit higher. There was a request for that, and that's been distributed to you today. There's another item, which is a spreadsheet that looks at the governor's recommended budget and how that was developed. Because of time limitations, we will not be going over that today, but we'll probably get back to some of this tomorrow, and if you want to take that with you, please do so. The third item is a packet here that the front page says enrollment growth projections, fundable FTE enrollment, and it has 12 pages which are labeled in pencil, the page numbers in the right. This is a set of materials that I put together in response to some questions that legislators had been bringing forward on this panel during the course of the hearings. And I would mainly, given the time, mainly just like to point out what's here and see if there are any questions. Otherwise, I won't going into this in much depth. But there were questions about what the enrollment projections were looking like. And this, on the first page, shows the projected growth in enrollments by institutions over the 2 year. This is a 2 year growth rate from this year, the one that we're currently in, until the next end of the next biennium. And these figures are very important under the new budget model because, of course, funding is very closely tied to student enrollment. And these are the fundable enrollments, that is to say the Oregon undergraduate students, the Oregon professional and master's level students, and the all doctoral students. And for Eastern, this includes their non-residents as well. But this shows that there's a substantial growth expected in enrollments, and that there's also substantial variation by institutions. Page 2 is also labeled slide 7. Any page, by the way, that doesn't say LFO on it is simply a copy of material from the Oregon University system. So this again shows the projected enrollment growth, breaks it down between undergraduate and graduate, and does not show it by institution, but the numbers on this page are consistent with the first page to the extent that they are listed on both pages. Page 3 is an issue that I think we will need to talk about more in work session tomorrow. It talks about funded enrollment under different funding levels, and this is something that is being reworked by higher ed even since this particular material was put together, but it does show that at different funding levels, the State Board of Higher Ed had recommended funding different numbers of students. And if you look at these student numbers here and you compare them to the page ahead of that, you'll see that under none of these are all of the undergraduate students that are projected being funded. But that's an issue that I think, you know, unless people want to get into it more right now, this is something that I think we'll need to talk about tomorrow in work session. The next set of pages, which go from page, what are labeled page 8 through page 10, talk about the cell values. And the committee was interested in information on these cell values as adjusted for the funding levels that were being considered and the other adjustments that the State Board had made. The numbers you'd seen earlier were the original funding requests that were developed last summer.
Could you tell us what cell values are?
Yes, and Senator. If you look to the next page, page 5, this is a table that shows the number of cell values. And what I mean by cell value is the state funds that are allocated per full-time equivalent enrollment in a particular program. So it's the dollars, it's the direct dollars per student funded by the state.
Okay, so it is the dollars per student.
For full-time equivalent students.
I wasn't quite sure.
And
student becomes a cell.
No,
that's our program.
In the cell. Maybe I've lost track of this. Weren't we talking about per FTE?
Yes, I say student. For student FTE, full-time equivalent enrollment, not full-time equivalent employment.
Okay.
I'm sorry, let me clarify that. In terms of FTE, in terms of the student enrollment, so a student that's enrolled half-time, basically taking 8 credit hours in a term instead of 15 would count as half, would receive half this funding. That's the same amount.
Thank you.
So I won't go into these numbers more at this point. Page 11 takes some information. I'd like to explain a little bit what this information is showing, because it's important information. I think it's something that people might tend to focus on, and therefore it's important to know really what it's showing in that case. These are figures from State Board's actions that were taken back in February. And again, I have to stress that there are modifications that are going on since then in response to concerns, particularly that the co-chairs and others have been expressing that would affect these numbers. But we don't have more up-to-date numbers now, and there was a request for this information. So I wanted to show you what we've got here. We've got the 7 institutions, and then we've got a column that shows their base expenditure budget. These are millions of dollars. So Eastern has a budget of $32.87 million in the biennium. That's a 2-year figure. And what this base expenditure budget is it's essentially a current service level concept for the what we call a limited budget. That's to say it doesn't include the auxiliary activities like the dorms and the cafeterias. It also doesn't include the research funding, the research grants that the institution's faculty are awarded. But this is the tuition and fees and state dollar supported budgets. The governor's recommendation, as the board had approved earlier, would increase the funding for each of these institutions by the amounts shown. So, for example, looking again at Eastern, under the governor's recommended level of funding, they would receive over the 2-year period $1.34 million above their base cost, which is 4.808% above the base.
Manager, and that's for 70, is that based on 73 in funding?
That's based on the governor's recommendation.
75.
73. Is the way the system has been representing that.
And just so I understand that too, the base budget expenditure is the current allocation as we have done it in the past, or is that under the model? So all of this is under a model umbrella distribution, is that right?
Right. It represents the what we would in state budgeting call a current service level. It is not exactly calculated in that manner, but it is similar in intent to that. It's basically bringing forward the costs of the institutions into the next biennium in a way that reflects the way we do that for state current service level calculation. Now, this is,
Representative Wilson?
Yes, thank you. Steve, to you again here, looking in the particular case of Eastern, the 1.34 under the governor, just as an example. That's biennium? Or, that is biennium.
That's correct. Yeah. All these figures are biennium.
All right, very good. Thank you.
This is Department of Higher Ed looked at different ways of representing the base expenditure budget, looked at different ways that would be most useful in determining the impact of this funding on the institution. And this particular showing of base expenditure budget is more closely aligned to current service level if we use it at the state level than some of the other ones. In particular, it does not look at the cost, or does not include expected increases in personnel costs because of contract awards that haven't already been approved. So, in other words, future contract increases. That's the way you budget at the state level as well. Higher ed had looked at this issue also and considered how much funding they might get for or might be able to expect for salary increases that they were expecting to have to pay in the next biennium. And in that case, the numbers were different. And you might have remembered hearing President Creighton, I believe it was yesterday or the day before, talk about $800,000 extra. And here you see $1.34 million. The difference between these two figures are, first of all, the figure on this page is 2 years, and President Creighton was talking about 1 year, and he was talking about looking at the different base where they were trying to take out from the increase here what they were expecting to be personnel costs that they wouldn't get state funding for. So these numbers are higher than that, but again, they are more parallel to what you would see with any state agency that you're budgeting for.
The question I'd like to ask, I guess, OUS is how there's another budget running out there with pay increase for employees, $40 million, and how, I guess that's not enough, that's half the amount. How does that then factor into this calculation as well?
That is not in this calculation. OUS did look at that, and they did have lower numbers here for the increases when they included that in the calculation.
What was that he said? That was
my understanding of Representative Edwards' question was, does the effect or the impact of having unfunded salary increases show up in these numbers?
Yeah.
Is that your question?
And assuming that's what is going to happen to the party. So how do those roll-up costs, if we're going to put out $40 million and it costs supposedly $80 million, that's what I'm hearing, how does that get absorbed by the system and how is that reflected in
there? I think we can talk about that tomorrow, but they are not reflected here on these numbers.
And often you just never know what happens after the effect. And I think we ought to know in front of the fact. As much as we can, anyway.
On the last page that I've included here, page 12, there were some questions about reserves in the system, reserve balances, and what was going on with these reserve balances. This is looking at the system overall. It's not broken down by institution, and some of that's very interesting to look at it by institution, but this is combined system-wide fund balances in the education and general budget, so it's excluding dorms and things of that nature. If you look just at the very bottom row there, the ending fund balance, You can see that the last year that this shows an ending fund balance system-wide of about $23 million. The figures for 98-99 are not available because we're still in that fiscal year, but OUS is projecting that it will stay pretty close to that level for another year, so again, in the roughly low 20s range. And you have heard that there is concern by the system that this figure is too low, and they would hopefully, they would have as a goal to eventually basically double it, plus any increases for inflation over that time, but basically to double this reserve level. And that would be part of what, how they would apply or how they would hope to apply additional funds or funds that become available to them through this budget.
Crash question. What about that beginning fund balance? If you look at the rather substantial decline from biennium to biennium in that means that they start with less money for their budget to begin with, and means then that if they're going to be funded well, that has to be made up. Before they had beginning balances, now they don't. Well, do you have any explanation for that?
That is actually the other side of the coin of the same issue here. This $22 million, $22,866,000, which is the ending balance, would become the beginning balance in the next year. So this is, as you can see, if you look at the change in fund balances here, for the first two fiscal years, expenditures were exceeding revenues by, $20 million or more, roughly. The system did turn that around and did that. If you look at the expenditure column, you can see that expenditure growth was held very low, and there's been some restoration of those fund balances.
Yeah, and I think also the underfunding and picking up the salary packages and things like that affect those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Representative?
Thank you, Steve. You went back to the first page to talk about enrollment growth, and again, I assume the source is OUS on that one.
Yes.
Can you show us kind of how accurate that's been relative to the past? I know in the budget you're asking for some enrollment demand. If you look again at your last page, you talked about actual tuition fees and the expected amount of enrollment doesn't hit. This is a pretty high enrollment, I'd say, overall, particularly it's an average for all of 9.5. That's a pretty healthy growth. And I'm not questioning that, I guess. Making sure that we're going to appropriate for something that looks for that. And we don't get there. I guess does that then drive down into the ending fund balance? I guess I'm trying to find some accuracy in those projections, historic, and then also.
Okay. They are projections, and they are high projections compared to what the type of growth that the system has recently been actually experiencing. And we can get some information. I saw Vice Chancellor Ansel nodding his head.
Do you want to come up and answer that?
But record is Bill Angelo, Bright City Clerk for Finance. Yes, as I attempted to answer Senator Cho's question, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, these are demand numbers. These are done early in the process and take into account the high school graduating classes, improved retention, increased college transfers, sort of standard processes. And our experience, if you look over the last 15 years, I think our highest year-to-year change was a little over 3%. So that these numbers, the demand number side of it is showing much higher than what our actual experience was in any of the last 10 years or so. What happens during the process is that these go from a demand to then an actual projection. As you get close into July of this year, we'll know what the applications are, we'll know what the admissions are, we'll know what our returning classes are, and then we adjust these on a rolling basis. it is likely, and part of our consideration of how many enrollments we were funding, it's likely that we might fall somewhat short of the peak of these demand numbers. I'm predicting something that hasn't happened yet. But what we have committed to, as you heard the Chancellor yesterday, is to serve all qualified undergraduates that come and look for admission. So what the board will do, we set annual budgets, we adjust those year to year, and we would at those points make those as accurate as possible. So they become increasingly accurate as you know more information. The purpose that we presented these to you is to show you what the demand might likely be. The reality is that we'll land somewhere close to this. It's probably not uncommon to fall, say, 1% short of these when all the actual information comes to be. It's hard to predict more closely than that. Looking at the other side of it, we're predicting that 99% will show up.
And since we have Dr. Youngblood, maybe she could comment on almost nearly 20% growth expectation. That's phenomenal.
That seems exceptionally high. There's a lot of targeted enrollment for teacher education that is going in there, and plus the fact that some additional adjustments to the program. Mr. Bender mentioned, we are continuously studying these as we get closer in, and some of these might adjust a bit. But if President Youngblood would care to comment on her particular situation, that's fine.
I think you covered it well.
One last thing, my familiarity is how we handle K-12 and distributing money, and every school district reassesses every year. They project their enrollments, and then the state reallocates depending on as we continue to hear. Is there a similar readjustment?
Recall that our past budgeting process, we came to you, we said what we thought we were going to do. The legislature would provide a total amount of money. This is our first movement towards this new funding kind of an approach where it's very sensitive to enrollment and both the tuition following the student as well as the majority of state tax dollars following the student. We are also struggling with the fact that we are trying to get this model funded at an appropriate level. So there's a trade-off between trying to make sure that we meet all that demand and not shortchange students and try to get the funding to the appropriate level that ensures success. With all the other cautionary tales about the cost of salary increases and events we can't predict. So my guess is I would argue, and this is just a personal reflection, that with the change in this model, with sort of the old model provided for status quo, if you remember part of the conversation, so it tended to pull it back. With this new model, it's trying to respond to change and trying to respond to change quickly. So I'm not scientifically inclined, but it's something like the halo effect or the Hawthorne effect, where you're going to have perhaps a sudden surge in the first couple of years of installing this new model and hopefully thereafter. So I think we're getting a little bit of that as well. And I'm hedging all over the place, but rightfully so, because you can't predict better than that.
Appreciate that. Thank you for your response.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you and good day, and we're adjourned, and be here till 8:30.